All right, let's talk about Friday's Child.
Okay.
What do you think?
I wanted to hate this episode.
Why?
I don't know, but there was a point when I realized that this was one of those where they meet a weird tribe all dressed weird and there's customs that, okay, it's going to be one of these episodes. And about half of it was really good.
They haven't really had one of those episodes, though.
Yeah, I know, but you can tell that Star Trek's the kind of show that has those kind of episodes, and now we're seeing it.
I mean, one of the interesting things about this episode is that this is probably the first example of this kind of episode.
Okay.
This does happen.
Yeah.
And this is one of the standard, like, seven Star Trek plots. So you have that to look forward to.
I'm excited in a very... interesting and...
some of them are good and some of them are bad. I guess you could consider The Apple is also in this sort of vein, but The Apple wasn't really about a different culture. It was about
a computer.
So there was no Vol in this episode controlling their actions. What do you mean when you liked about half of it? What half did you like and what half did you not like?
Okay, so this entire one of the main characters in this episode is this woman who is the wife of basically their chief, the Tyr, they call them. And anytime she is on screen, the episode is amazing because she is probably one of the most interesting characters that I've seen in Star Trek so far beyond the original cast.
Yeah.
When she's not on the screen, there's... the plot was extremely unfocused because you have, you know, this decoy on the ship and you have the Klingon and you have and then they have this war between the Tyr and his second. And, you know, then you have these rules and they have to kill the woman and then they're killing the guy because and it's just like it seemed like there was a little too much plot in the episode. And while it all does mesh together in the end, it felt very unfocused.
Well, I mean,
I guess I'm just... it partially might just be I'm not as invested in this character of this other guy who's taking control of, you know, this tribe or whatever. And I just wanted to see this pregnant woman kicking ass and climbing rocks. Like, I think that may have just been all it was.
I mean, there's a couple different things there, right? Is that, you know, number one, you don't have... the pregnant woman kicking ass unless the Tyr is murdered, and you can't really set the episode up with him being already dead, because we do need to meet him first to establish how this society functions when that happens.
I know why they did what they did. I feel like it could have been done a little tighter.
I guess you know, the episode does have a couple of scenes that probably could have been trimmed and like you said, replaced with something else that went into that a little bit more and tightened it up a bit. But, you know, on the whole, I think it's an effective episode. And all of the disparate pieces, while they may not seem to work well together, by the end, they all do tie into each other. And, you know, take the Klingon, for example.
Yeah.
There's really no reason... for the Klingon to be there on first glance, but it does two things for the episode at the end. What it does is it sets up a reason for the Enterprise to care about this conflict aside from the mineral contract. I mean, because come on, that's boring. Like, we're not going to have an episode about mining contracts.
Yeah, getting a mining contract, you know, or not is not an interesting plot, but keeping the mining contract out of the hands of the Klingons.
Yeah.
That is interesting because that would, you know, whoever gets this planet will have a massive resource advantage.
And it also nicely ties in at the end, of course, because... The society here, the Capellans, are situated, and I like the fact that at the very beginning of the episode they're introduced because McCoy was established to have been stationed on this planet for a few months, and he has knowledge of their culture and this kind of thing, which I like. And he does this nice thing with the Klingons specifically, where you know, Kirk is about to put his foot in his mouth when the Klingon says something when he's in front of the Tyr. And, you know, McCoy takes it over and just is totally like, I just called that dude a liar.
Yeah,
Kirk.
But is it like his words are hollow or something like that?
Unimportant.
Unimportant, yeah. He has like this very... and everybody else in the room just laughs at him because, you know, apparently this is this huge insult.
Yeah. And by the end of the episode, that, you know, the Klingon has a role there because, of course, it sets up a nice, because, you know, we've seen the Klingons once before and we don't really know that much about them other than they're an enemy of the Federation and they're very violent.
Yeah.
And that, you know, they're not peaceful like the Federation, and they conquer. They do not, you know, they do not share, basically.
You have to say, there might be a, the Mirror Universe episode. I wonder if, you know, that's what I think Klingon must be like, what the evil Enterprise is.
Yeah. I mean, pretty much.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the case.
Yeah.
So it does set up a nice, you know, dichotomy there between the Federation and the Klingons again. And it gives us information about the Federation. I like it because it gives us information about the Federation sort of in absentia. Like, it is set up as, we're not telling you what the Federation is. We're telling you what the Federation isn't through the example of the Klingons.
Okay.
And, of course, the other thing is that the Enterprise, under the command of Scotty, goes off on this wild goose chase with the Klingons, who are faking distress signals. And so you do get that as well. Like, there's a little bit of a higher stakes there because the Enterprise is in danger again.
I also get the sense that this entire revolution, essentially, that happens on Capella is the Klingons' instigation. My assumption is that just before, obviously, you know, the Klingon realized that this one won't negotiate, but notices the second has some ambition, and obviously the Klingons are going to back that up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Klingon totally does.
Yeah,
I mean, there's even an explicit scene towards the end where, you know, the Klingon says, oh, well, we had an agreement. And, you know, basically he's like, eh, you know, whatever. I don't care.
But I think that's very interesting because before the revolution happens, you know, the second, and I don't know any of their names or what their exact roles are, so I hope that everybody is following along. But the second is basically very power hungry, very ambitious, wants to do, you know, is going, wants power, is going with the Klingons, but he's about to, at one point, right when he takes power, Kirk says, remember, you're making decisions for a lot more people now. And the new tier stops for a second and thinks and says, yeah, basically, yeah, you're right. I have a lot more people to think about. And, you know, the Klingon gets upset. He's like, no, I have to reevaluate this. And
sure.
I think that's a very interesting facet of this guy's character, because while he is very ambitious, very power hungry, is willing to murder the chief of his tribe to get ahead, he does so because he believes that he will do what is best for his planet or his country or whatever. And
he eventually does.
Yes. And I think that speaks very well of him. While he is able to be manipulated by the Klingons, or he does, you know, threaten Kirk, he's only doing it for a noble reason. I think that says something very specific about what leadership needs to be.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And, you know, I think it's interesting because when you get into the last probably half of the episode, maybe 20 minutes or so, and it becomes a sort of like adventure romp with Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and a pregnant woman in the mountains.
Yeah.
And it is interesting, too, because this is the first time that we've seen location shooting this season.
Oh, yeah.
Because the budget was cut and they just could not do as much location shooting. Hmm. And they don't even do, like, the location isn't even really location shooting all the time. Like, it's location shooting when they're in the mountains, and then when they're by the cave, it's like the set again. It's really bizarre. And it's kind of, I don't know, it's weird. Like,
they had like a day where they could do the mountains, and then the rest they just did in studio.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the one problem I have with the second season of Star Trek, and the, you know, the third season too, because it had even less of a budget. That, you know, the lack of location shoot, like, we really liked the location shooting in the first season.
Yeah.
They did a lot of it, and the lack of it in the second season makes the show feel, I mean, I still love the show, but it does make it feel like a little hokier than it did in the first season.
At the same time, I think the second season has seen a massive increase in what they're doing for costumes. There have been a lot more weird alien costumes in this season than were in the first season, and
but we see more aliens.
Yes,
too.
And I think that if we have to make a trade, I like what we have here, because I think that it's one thing to see you know, weird planets and be told that these are all diverse species. It's another to see that they have, you know, we were talking in the Babel episode.
Babar?
Yes. In Babar, the elephant meets Captain Kirk. You know, everything takes place on the Enterprise, but everyone's wearing such weird costumes that it feels like many very disparate cultures. And we definitely see that on this planet. They're dressed very differently.
I mean, at the same time, though, the costumes in this episode are ridiculous.
Well, yeah.
And also, I mean, the fact of the matter is, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but at the same time, I really lament the lack of location shooting, because it means that we never really get an episode like Arena in this season, because, you know, that's a fantastic episode. It's basically all outside, and it also has a weird alien in it. So there is some, you know,
that's true.
It's like, I understand what you're saying, but it's like a lack of something there.
And it's possibly one of those, I'm trying to find a small consolation.
Yeah, so stop doing that.
I'm sorry, I'm a terrible person.
But what I think is interesting about the whole romp through the mountains is they do a very strange thing with the female character.
Yeah, so let's talk about this.
Yeah, I think we have to talk about her. What did you make of her as a character?
I think she's... Okay, see, the thing is, her society has some elements of subordination of women to it. But that being said, this is a very complex character who is showing her agency or lack thereof in relation to this society. In other words, while the society has, you know, believes that, oh, if you're carrying the child of the tear, you have to be killed. You know, while the society has this horrible rule, the show does not agree with that. The show does not agree with the position of women. And so she is able to use, she knows what rights she does have, and she demands each one of them. She very specifically says, you know, oh, you know, Kirk touches her at one point, and that's a death sentence. And she said, you know, it's my right to see him dead. You know, I'm demanding that. The part when McCoy's trying to examine her and she keeps slapping him, you know, because she doesn't want him to touch her. They are said to not really have doctors, and based on some of her conversation, they don't even seem to really have midwives or anything like that. So, you know, she slaps him a couple times and he's trying to. So finally he hits her and she's just like, all right, examine, you know, just, which I thought was funny just because it's not that... it's the one thing where hitting a pregnant woman, I think, doesn't come off as horrible as it could have, because I think she is a very strong character who does view this interplay of physical domination either way as almost a challenge. I don't think she feels so much dominated by Bones as she made an attack and he made an attack and okay, they're even.
See, I can totally see that reading of the character.
And I will say, even then, just to continue, while she is climbing the mountains, she's about to give birth and she's obviously having a struggly time and McCoy is helping her. Spock and Kirk are offering and she's saying, no, I'll it's okay for him to, but I that's it. And she is with very difficulty putting all the effort onto herself. You know, she may have realize that necessity allows for, you know, necessity requires Bones to be, you know, touching her, which is something she is not used to because of the rules of their culture, but that's fine. The others do not get that right.
Yeah.
And I think that that's says something very specific about her, that she is only willing to take the minimum of help because she feels that it would degrade her to take more than that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I totally understand what you're saying, but I think I don't agree with you about the role of women in this society, because I don't think that we get enough information to really make that sort of claim.
And that's fair. We can talk about the role of the Tear's wife.
Well, yeah, because I think it has more to do with the fact that she's the wife of the Tear and she's carrying the Tear's child. And We really only know that the Tear's wife, when she's carrying a child, is not allowed to be touched. And if anybody touches her, they're immediately put to death. Now, there could be many good reasons for that, notwithstanding, you know, someone trying to kill her to kill the what, you know, to kill the child and the heir to the throne, any sort of thing, you know. And we don't really see that many Capellan women in this episode. Yeah, we see one in the beginning where they're offering food to Kirk. But they're not offering food.
They're offering a challenge.
Like they're like, if you take the food, then they're gonna that's an invitation to fight.
Yeah.
Which McCoy realizes and you know tells him not to take it. So I think the fact that it's a woman is probably incidental there. And so in that, I think maybe it's a woman just because you could even say that the Capellans send a woman to do that because they realize that the Federation or perhaps humans have a different view of women than they do. And I at the very end of the episode, when the second in command who becomes the Tyr after he kills the first Tyr, you know, puts his life, he forfeits his life.
Yes.
He decides that what he has done is wrong and forfeits his life and the Klingon actually shoots him. Not the Tyr's wife, but you know.
Yeah.
She doesn't have a phaser. the implication at the end of the episode is that she's going to act as regent until her child is old enough to assume the throne. Yes. And so I don't think that, you know, a society that would be that hostile to women would allow that to happen. At the same time, we have many examples in our own history where women have become powerful figures just because there were no men. And, you know, I mean, Queen Elizabeth is a prominent example of that, for example.
Oh, yeah.
And that, you know, perhaps she is respected because she is so strong, and that, you know, women have to be more strong and act more like men, really, to get the respect from the men in their society.
I mean, I would say maybe it doesn't have to be as gendered, because I think they definitely view that anybody has respect by, you know, because they're fighting. They don't have medicine because they're basically told, you know, that's for the weak, you know, curing somebody who is injured or sick, you know, almost a natural selection thing. Well, they aren't tough enough to survive in the world. And so male or female, if you are not the type of person who could be going through a medical condition and still be able to fight and, you know, walk down a mountain, then you're not a full member of society.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see, I think the reason they send a woman to offer this food to Kirk, I don't know, that almost seemed it seemed the setup to a really weird cultural joke, by which I mean, you know, woman dressed very pretty, comes in, you know, offers food to Kirk, and immediately offers food, which, by the way, looks like a scrotum, to Kirk, and you immediately think, having seen episodes of Star Trek before, oh God, here's the alien lady who falls immediately in love with Kirk, and they're going to have a romance. And then Kirk says no, and then Bones says no, she's not offering you, you know, sex. You know, they think fighting is more pleasurable than sex. If you take that, that means you get to fight her brother. And then the brother comes in and looks a little upset that he hasn't, you know, offered that challenge. Like, that's a joke in a way to me. Like, I found that very funny. It's a weird little bait and switch from what you were expecting.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, you know, Star Trek doesn't get enough credit probably for being funny. And it is funny.
Yeah. From that scene, I get the sense that there probably is a segregation of sex between the, on this planet, which is a major facet of many societies throughout history. So we are obviously seeing what most of the men are doing, but based on how this, you know, woman is acting, it is possible that, you know, maybe all the Capellan women are that tough.
Yeah,
maybe
it could be.
But they just happen to live separately.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I also think, you know, moving on to a separate subject, it's interesting to me that the Capellans are set up as being more like Klingons in the beginning. And then by the end of the episode, they're seen as being very honorable people who, you know, do have these sort of strange ideas that the Federation does not necessarily agree with in terms of the role of violence in society, yeah, and the role that power has in society, and the role that we take with the sick and injured, all things that the Capellans have in common with the Klingons and not the Federation. But the Capellans, I think the episode is telling us, it's using the Capellans to tell us something about the Klingons, yes, without really giving us an example of Klingon society, which I think is interesting.
See, what I think is, I think the Capellans and the Second especially respect the Klingons because on the surface, the Klingons are all about...
They're similar.
Yeah, they're about power. They're about this. But then as the episode gets on, it becomes very clear that their power over rather than power for. And, you know, Kirk explicitly says, you know, you sign on with the Klingons, you are going to be a part of their empire and be on their laws. You know, you sign on with the Federation while we're going to negotiate some agreements and, you know, we're getting some of the mining rights here. For the most part, that's about it. You can just govern your society. However, you're not going to be occupied. And, you know, the Klingons seem to care about ambition, about power, but for its own end. And because the Tyr by being willing to reconsider, because eventually at the beginning, he thinks that the old Tyr is making the wrong decision. That's why he goes with this. He begins to realize that.
Well, does he think the Tyr is making the wrong decision, or does he just view the Klingon as an opportunity to take power?
I think it could be a little of both.
Sure.
Because if he didn't believe that the Klingons were wholeheartedly the right decision for Capella, if the old Tyr weren't, you know, still weighing this decision and looking possibly not in favor of the Klingons, or if the Federation was going to give a better deal for Capella by the new Tyr's estimation, then I think he would have made some overtures towards negotiation about that. He would have taken Kirk to the side and said, like, look, here's the deal I'm getting. Beat that. I think he's just very convinced that the right thing for Capella is to go with the Klingon.
I disagree with you, actually, because I think that he wants power, and I don't really think he cares where he gets it. And I think what you're missing here is that it's not that he thinks the Klingons are better for Capella and so he's going to honor their agreement, but it's that he himself is honorable and honors his agreements, whether or not he may think that they're right for Capella. And I think that's kind of the point of his character, that we see that he doesn't know what is good for Capella and he doesn't really care until the end, when he realizes the error of his ways.
But he's the kind of character who can realize the error. And I think it is interesting that it is the wife of the Tyr who's the one who shames him into committing suicide, essentially.
Yeah. No, yeah, absolutely.
She basically accuses him of not being manly enough, and he realizes, you know, the pregnant woman who just climbed down from the mountain is right.
What do you make of, you know, to go back to the Tyr's wife, what do you make of the whole relationship that McCoy and she developed? Because I honestly have never really been able to make that much sense of it.
I feel like part of it is her realizing that, okay, this, you know, she must have some maternal feelings towards this child and does realize that, okay, you know, I'm going to be killed either way.
But she says she hates the child at one point. I mean, is she lying? I don't know.
You can feel ambivalent both ways. Yeah. I mean, she... Number one, what the child represents is something certainly that she's maybe not justified in understandably she hates it. I believe it's just a feeling of ambivalence. She does not know how to feel about this child. And I think she realizes that McCoy might be the best chance for this child, so she can she has to die either way, so... Maybe I think there is an element where, yes, she is very grateful to him and she is very, she does learn, you know, decide to trust him, and she does realize that he will, you know, take care of her and take care of this kid. He is her best hope. At the same time, I think she kind of plays into him a little more than she leads on, because the second his back is turned, she runs away. You know, the second she's able to walk, she does it. I think...
And if, she leaves the baby.
Yeah.
Let's not forget that.
Yeah. I think if she were feeling a little more along the ways that she was speaking, she may not have been so quick to go.
Yeah.
She just feels that... Either way, she feels that she has this duty in this specific way, and, you know, she's going to do what she can for this kid, but then she has to go.
Yeah, that might be fair. All right. Well, I think we've covered it. I don't think there's anything else to say. Do you have anything else to say?
Fuck Chekhov.
Okay,
the
good.
The second that Kirk's like, I wonder what's on the ship. I'm Chekhov. I'm Russian. And I'm like, fuck.
Yeah, Chekhov.
Also, yeah.
Anyway, so how many triples would you give this one?
I will give the 7 triples.
7. Okay. I'll go with that. 7
yeah,
triples.
Yeah, it was a very good, solid episode. There's some things that it would have changed, but nothing... You know, nothing major, and it wouldn't have gotten much better, but I liked it.
Yeah. All right, well, let's move on to the Deadly Years.
So, yes, the Deadly Years.
Okay, sure. What did you think about the Deadly Years?
I actually liked this episode very, very much because Chekhov spends the majority of it getting blood drawn.
Yeah, they kind of put him through some torture here.
Yeah, he
and they seem almost happy about it.
Wouldn't you be?
Yeah, I guess I would be.
I mean, this is... Poor Dr. McCoy is aging rapidly, and every 5 minutes his accent gets thicker and thicker, and he, you know, goes more and more rural, but at least there's a small consolation as then he gets to scrape skin samples off of Chekhov. I cannot say that phrase.
It's weird, though, because as McCoy gets older... His southern accent comes out more, and he's like, I'm just an old country doctor. Like,
yeah, like, so, Spock, quit your jaw.
Yeah, like, what are we supposed to make of that? Because it almost makes me think that, like, there is still prejudice against people from the South in the 23rd century, and so he has to cover it up. Like, what? I don't understand that.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's weird.
Unless it's just as simple as he... you know, grows up in Georgia, so obviously he has this accent, but he is working on not just an international, but an interplanetary thing, and then the accents kind of mesh less with certain people.
I don't think so, because it always seems like when his defenses are down, like, he slips into that, because it happened in this side of paradise,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I assume that, yeah, it must be something that he... either consciously or, you know, an affectation or something he did in college to... Because I've known plenty of people from the South who, in college, made a point to, you know, start speaking a bit more of a...
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, you know, I grew up in Delaware, and you know, I when I was a kid, I used to say water instead of water, and I kind of trained myself out of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's that kind of thing, I guess.
Yeah, I assume it's something similar.
Okay, so what did you think about this plot, and what did you think about the characters in it?
It's very difficult because I'm on the cusp of 30, and the characters are 30, and they're like, we're 30 years old! And I'm like, oh god, that's what I look like now.
It's funny because this episode is a lot of fun, and
yeah.
You never, I mean, obviously, like, you don't ever really think that they're all going to die except for Chekhov. So it doesn't really seem, and poor Scotty, like, how incidental does he seem to the entire episode?
I know. They put, like, a mask on him, and it's just like he has the one scene, and you could tell because he was one of the oldest of the cast, right?
No, I don't think so.
Really? I at least just based on how they looked, I always thought he was a little older.
I'm not sure, actually. I think DeForest Kelly was... Well, DeForest Kelly was younger than he looks, because DeForest Kelly looks old.
Okay, I mean, I either way, he looks, well, we can agree he looks older than most of the cast, so...
But I'm fairly certain, I mean, James Doohan and DeForest Kelly are the first two cast members in the original series to die, so we can infer from that they were the oldest, but, you know, Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner are certainly no spring chickens at this point.
I also like... I thought it was funny because we know what, you know...
We know what they look like these ages now,
They're at more or less the age that, they are today. So it's funny how they don't... That's not how Shatner looks these days anymore, you know, but...
No, they sort of miss the fact that Shatner would sort of expand...
Become square.
Expand a bit, let's say, and become a bit doughy. Now, you know, and it's funny because, you know, we can joke about it, but it's weird. I like the makeup. Okay, we'll just put this out here. The makeup does not look good in high definition. Like,
no.
it is not high, you know, HD is not kind to this makeup. And especially the very beginning of the episode where they go down to the planet and we have never seen any of the colonists before, right?
Yeah.
So we have no conception of what they should look like, young or old. I mean, obviously, they're not going to cast old people to play, well, you know, Kirk and Spock and things
because,
you know, they'll need makeup for that those characters. But
and they cast old people as these two main colonists.
Who were supposed to be like 29 and 27 or something, which is fine. And they're cute and adorable. And I wish they had not died because I loved them so much. But just like cute old people who were actually like 25. But they Chekhov finds a dead body and it's very obviously someone in old makeup.
I'm could cast another old person and be like, lie down, take a nap for about 5 minutes, we'll film it.
I don't understand why they didn't do that.
I mean I mean there was the sense that he was older than old, this guy. Like I assume the progression was so advanced in him, but again, then you could still take a really you could find a really decrepit old person.
What, like Star Trek Bible stories? Like Chekhov found the body of Methuselah.
I was thinking more of like a you know, there's lepers or something like that.
Okay,
that's a thing, right, in the Bible?
Sure, yeah, lepers. Let's go with that.
Yeah, I don't know, but are you with me in that the plot makes no sense? Like the episode doesn't really care why they have this thing, or it doesn't really make sense why they cure from it, but
this is a very early example of technobabble.
Yeah, they just make something up because the entire plot of the episode is we wanted to put people in old makeup, and we wanted to have them, you know, have an inch plague. Probably can't figure out anything, but just don't worry about it.
It reminds me a lot of the naked time.
Yeah.
In that you've got this weird thing going on and they don't know why it's happening. And the last 5 minutes of the episode are them discovering why it's happening and coming up with a cure. None of it really makes any sense. In the naked time, it was a virus that had, transformed from water. I forget.
Sure.
Something like that.
Put the very bright lights and made Spock blind. What was that?
Operation Annihilate.
That one. Yeah. Like they have a few things like that, I assume. But again, the point isn't how this is not a medical mystery. It's not realistic. No one cares.
Yeah. the point is not that. The point is the interplay and the characters.
Yeah.
What this sort of thing, it's trying to examine, you know, what this sort of thing would do to people, how they would react, you know, what would happen. And of course, I think it does it pretty well. I mean, because it's funny to see Kirk get grumpy.
Yeah.
And McCoy to just get happy and old, and perhaps he's sneaking whiskey. We don't know. Scotty becomes whatever he becomes. And Spock
gets to be late middle age, but that's because he's so much older, even though he is growing rapidly. He's probably more akin to somebody, you know, in their late 60s who is still, you know, in as perfect health as you can be, you know, and whose mind is still pretty sharp, but just starting to slow, you know? And so, you know, Spock is almost scared that he's normal. His brain is normal now.
Well, there's that great scene with the Commodore where the Commodore tricks Spock into admitting that Kirk is not fit for command because Spock is not fit for command.
Yeah.
And, you know, Spock realizes that he needs to accept that this hearing has to happen because he realizes that if he had not been slipping mentally, the Commodore could not have tricked him into admitting that.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting as well.
And I mean, it's just the Commodore uses logic against Spock, and Spock, I think, realizes that, yeah, that's flawless logic. And, you know, Spock, no matter what, if you give him a good syllogism, he'll go with it.
Yeah, Spock has no ego.
Yeah.
I think we can say. And he realizes that if the logic takes him where he follows the logic wherever it's going to go, basically.
Yeah.
And in this case, it follows it to a hearing where, and it's interesting as well because, you know, when Spock comes to tell Kirk that he has been relieved of command, and the hearing scene, I think, is really well done. And it's certainly better than, you know, like court martial or even the menagerie, which was kind of boring as well. Well, court martial wasn't boring. It was just
boring.
It was what it was.
Yeah.
But if you would like to know our thoughts on court martial, you can go back a few episodes.
We have no idea which one it is.
Let's say 7.
Yes. Go listen to episode 7 right now and rate it highly on iTunes.
There you go. Good job, Richard. That you really do, like, you know, Sulu and Uhura are testifying.
Yeah.
You know, and they're sort of just like, Uhura especially does not want to say what she is saying.
Yeah,
and
but they also
feel very badly for him.
You can tell that Spock's, you know, heart is broken while he's doing this, because he does not. The reason Spock protects the captain as much as he can is out of respect for him, and they all know that. They are seeing a great man about to, you know, dying and not able to handle that and losing all of his dignity. I mean, the spot when he's trying to, Kirk is trying to defend himself and just kind of going incoherent and making all these mistakes and just like.
Yeah, he's like, well, I don't want to do that because I'm an old man and I have a bat. You know, like it's just.
Yeah, like
saying,
he falls
like,
asleep on
stuff.
The bridge. It's, you know.
Oh, yeah,
it's
I forgot about that.
But. Everybody's just looking at each other like just they can't watch this. It's very hard for them. And
yeah,
it's
I mean, I think I do. I will say I think the one false step in the episode is the scene where Spock comes to tell Kirk that he has been relieved of command. And Kirk goes on this weird like rant to Spock about how he always wanted this. And,
you know,
he knew this was going to happen and he had to stab him in the back. And it's just like. I don't understand where that came from because Kirk doesn't feel that way about Spock and never has.
I mean, unless he's just old and going crazy. That's the implication.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought it was funny that out of all of them, Shatner got the least like aging makeup. Like he just had a little gray on the temples, you know, a couple of wrinkles, and he even had a shirtless scene to you know, so the audience knows he's still kind of in his prime, you know? So it feels like they overcompensated for the lack of physical changes by putting kind of the mental changes a bit more extreme.
And I'm sure that was all Shatner being egotastic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, I don't want to look old, you know, so.
Yeah, of course, you know, and again, Spock goes a little slip, you know, McCoy and Scotty look awful. But
McCoy turns into like the Crypt Keeper.
I mean,
like it's crazy. He's got this crazy hair and what about the lieutenant
with the pixie cut that suddenly goes long when she goes old? Like,
who has my favorite line in the episode? Incidentally,
which one?
What a stupid place to hang a mirror.
It
comes out of nowhere, and she's just like, I'm old and angry. And then 5 minutes later, she drops dead in sickbay.
I like the moment when she's about, you know, when she's, you know, crying because this is all happening. And Kirk goes and he's like, you know, Lieutenant, you've got to do this. You know, you have your duties. And, like, he says it kind of very firmly, like, you know, like, I know, this sucks. This is really bad, you know. Okay, that's as you grieved. Let's go to work. And she, you know, looks and she's like, yeah, you know, it's another example of, you know, Kirk does go very compassionately, but he does expect a lot of his people, but
yeah,
because they're capable of it.
Oh, sure, absolutely. What do you make of the subplot with the endocrinologist who has a romantic history with Kirk? It's implied that he broke it off with her or she broke it
off
with him.
They had a two-body problem, basically.
Yeah, like he had his career and she had her career.
Yeah, assumingly hers is one that, you know, is mostly staying in research stations or something, and obviously his takes him everywhere. So, yeah, they almost rekindle their romance. You know, they talk about old times a little bit before they can really do anything serious about it. The plot happens. You know, because at one point she says, you know, I admired, you know, my husband, you know, we were in a research, you know, for years, you know, but, you know, sometimes, you know, I regret not being with you. You know, that was the only, not, you were the only thing I had to give up, you know?
You know, it's No, it's funny because I actually really like this subplot. I don't like a lot of the romance subplots that Kirk gets because it just comes around to he wants some alien tale.
Yeah.
But I like this one because it humanizes Kirk in a way that I don't think we've really seen before, except for maybe in Operation Annihilate when we do see his brother, his wife and son, mm-hmm. his nephew. And I like it because she is definitely, in the Star Trek vein of woman, I am sexy, wearing her pink dress and everything. But we don't ever really get a sense that she's not competent. She does help come up with the antidote, the cure for this thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, Shatner plays the scenes that they have together very interestingly, in that he's playing them very subtly. And you can kind of get a sense of a man who still loves this woman, but is holding back from that because he knows that it's not going to be possible.
That's it. They know that, you know, they're meeting after all these years, and they're talking about, you know, it would be really nice, and they do still feel that. Yeah, but at the same time, they still have a two-body problem. They're still as invested in their career, and it's not even considered that either of them would give that up. I did appreciate that, because how many times have we seen the woman give everything up for the man in the series?
And the script is really smart about it, because she still cares about him even as he's aging and getting older and sicker. So there's no sense here that this is just about sex. This is really about love and affection, and these two people really caring for each other. And of course, you know, the implication as well that, you know, towards the end of the episode, when she gets to see him in his full glory again, and she does help cure him, that you know, perhaps something will happen, and it may not be a good idea.
Well, I figured that, well, you know, because it does end with the two of them, you know, off to go off. And yes, I figured they would probably each find a way to beg off for a couple days, you know, spend some time together, maybe even make an effort to get a shore leave or two. But obviously, that's as much as they can ever do.
Yeah.
So I think they're just taking the time they can at the moment and moving on for that.
Yeah, I think so. You know, we touched on this a little bit with Chekhov and the torture porn of Chekhov here. You know, and what do you think about Chekhov being the catalyst for the cure? Do you think it works? Because I have some problems with it. I mean,
it's again, because I didn't feel that the cure really mattered. The reasoning behind the cure, behind why Chekhov wasn't, because he had adrenaline at the time and
he was scared.
But none of them, upon being told, okay, you've gotten radiation poisoning that within a week is going to age you and kill you, and you will go senile and crazy days before that happens. None of them got a little nervous about that. Like, no matter how tough Captain Kirk is, you would think there would be at least 5 minutes where he was not very happy.
Yeah, and I guess the implication there is that, like, they needed some sort of, like, super dose or something.
Yeah, but then how does he make a super dose just by seeing a dead body? And if Chekhov is the kind of person who will see one dead body and freak out enough to produce this super dose of adrenaline, then why is he... How did he get accepted to Starfleet in the first place?
Well, that's an interesting question, because that brings me to my next point, which is that I like that the show is setting Chekhov up as perhaps not being as competent with it as these people, because any other character on the show, when they walked into that room and saw the dead body, they'd be like, oh, all right.
They might be shocked or upset, but
they're not going to go running out of the room frightened to death just by seeing a dead body. So there is an implication there that Chekhov is extremely inexperienced.
Yeah.
And that perhaps they don't even really like him all that much.
Oh, nobody in this seems to mind that he's being...
It's almost like McCoy has found a substitute for his needling of Spock in needling of Chekhov. I mean, McCoy likes to needle everybody.
Oh, yeah,
but
that's what he does. But at this point, you know, he can really needle Chekhov a lot.
Yeah.
I think he's been waiting for this excuse.
What do you think? Okay, so the other thing that's in this episode, of course, is the Commodore subplot, where he's a flag officer, but he's not. He's never had a command, and the Romulans. The Romulans are back. Richard.
Yes, I noticed that. I thought that was interesting, because he is one of the most sympathetic Starfleet commander people who has used regulations in order to get Kirk out of the way. Like, the entire time, every single scene that this Commodore has, he's very apologetic. Like, he you know, when he's talking to Spock, he's like, you know, he goes out of his way to say, I have so much respect for Kirk, you know, and when he's in the trial, I think he says as well, you are a great officer. You are, you know, he is making it very clear that this is not like in court martial, the result of a personal grudge or anything like that. It's just because, and if his desire to realize that, you know, Kirk not being at his best will put many lives in danger, and he is doing the best thing. While the Commodore himself taking the command turns out to not be the right move, and he admits as much when Kirk comes back, getting Kirk out of the way was the right decision, and I think everybody realizes that the Commodore feels that way. There is no resist. Anytime someone else has taken over the bridge, everybody else has been very upset at him. That's not the case here.
Yeah, I actually, and this again is, I think, a sign that the script is really smart and knows what it's doing and works on a lot of different levels, because I like the Commodore's character a lot, and he is definitely not one of those like Federation functionaries that appear in an episode just to be like, I am an obstacle to the plot. He has his own motivations. He has his own personality. They characterize him extremely well in the limited amount of time that they have to see him on screen. And you do get a sense that he's a man who, you know, is a little over his head, and Kirk is dismissive of him, calling him a desk-bound paper pusher at one point. But there's no malice there. It's just that he doesn't realize how difficult it is to command a starship, and he makes a really bad decision to take the Enterprise to Starbase 10 going through the neutral zone. But everybody realizes that his intention was good.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, everything was fine because Kirk was able. I mean, you know, it's a little convenient that Kirk was able to get cured just as this was happening. But and the ease in which Kirk immediately comes solution with the problem. I mean, Corbinite comes back. But
I want to talk about that solution, actually, a second, which beyond the callback to Corbinite, which is awesome. I like how they do this business with this code, too.
Yeah.
So at one point, you know, he tells, you know, her, oh, do this within code, you know, send a message to the Federation, you know, explaining what's going on and use code 2 for this. And she says, you know, the Romulans have broken code 2. And he says, oh, we'll use code 3. And this is also, again, brought up during the trial as one of that's what Uhura testifies as one of the things that Kirk should know that he's slipping on. And once he comes in, he says, all right, you know, send a message using code 2. And, like, Uhura gets, like, this, you know, like, shit.
Are you okay? This is happening.
And he's like, no, seriously, code 2. And he just gives this fake message, you know. And I think that was very interesting because I didn't expect it to go that way. Like, I thought that the business with that had been finished already. And then they brought it up in this completely other context. And plus the thing of Corbinite, that was a nice surprise.
It's nice because it's definitely an example of a really the writer knew what he was doing, and was setting things up, you know, for payoff much later down the line. And you know, you can definitely see a much lesser version of this episode where, you know, something like, as you know, code 2 has been broken, you know, like that kind of thing, which they don't do. It serves two purposes in the episode.
Yeah, telling. You know, when Uhura says code 2 has been broken, she is telling the audience, but there is a justifiable reason why this captain of the starship does not know that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. What do you make of the Romulans in this episode? Because we don't really see Romulans. We just, they're ships and they're firing at the Enterprise.
That's it. I felt it was like Corbinite, this writer has, you know, loved the first season and loved those two episodes and just wanted to make a reference. It's something which makes the world seem more real, certainly, because if it was another alien species, you know, who cares? You know, if you have never seen an episode before, Romulan just gets changed to evil alien, it's fine. If it's not, we know a little bit more about their history from Balance of Terror.
Yeah, sure. Why do you, I mean, I'm going to ask you this as someone who's not familiar with Star Trek. Why do you think that of all of the alien races that have encountered the Enterprise over the course of this season and a half, that the Klingons and the Romulans are the ones that come back?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just they had the most potential for them. The Gorn are not that interesting, you know.
But they could be. I mean, we don't know anything more about the Gorn than we did about the Klingons in Errand of Mercy.
And maybe it was just they needed, you know, to get...
And you didn't like Balance of Terror, so you I mean, obviously you felt that the Romulans perhaps did not have much... potential, but they come back in this episode. So
again, I don't feel like that they're doing anything more. You know, this may have even been for the fact that they, because I assume the Romulans then appear more times throughout the rest of the series.
Yeah,
maybe they had the ideas of where they wanted Romulan society to go. They didn't necessarily want to go into that in this episode. They didn't want to characterize the Romulans, but they didn't, for many reasons, want to come up with a completely new alien species. And again, to set up, like, well, no, maybe later on we're going to go into more detail. So we're going to set, you know, this might be just setting them up as a name that you remember. And then in another episode when we see more of the Romulans, oh yeah, rather than just those are the ones from Balance of Terror, you say those are the ones from Balance of Terror and the Deli years. You know, those rascally Romulans, they were dangerous. Making him recurring makes it seem more dangerous.
Possibly. Yeah, but that wasn't my question. My question, I mean, I understand that. My question is, why do you think they picked the Klingons and the Romulans?
Could be just the writer liked them. I don't know.
Yeah, could be. I don't know.
I know that. It's hard to say this just because the names Klingon and Romulans are so... Since I know where they end up within the series mythology, it's hard to see their origins and extrapolate how that would happen. Do you know what I mean? The fact that Klingon is a name that everybody knows is so it's so set in stone that it feels like an inevitability. So I'm not sure if I'm able to answer that question. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I guess I just find it interesting. I mean, and this is why pressing you at this on this a little bit. Well, I mean, I think the best candidate for a recurring alien that was not the Klingons or the Romulans was probably the Gorn. And I honestly think that they didn't use the Gorn just because it didn't look great.
See, that I don't really think of the Gorn as a possible recurring because I think they're just a bunch of evil alligators.
So are the Klingons. I mean, that's what we saw in Errand of Mercy. I mean, there was really no interest there.
Yeah,
I mean, they were as interesting. The Klingons in Errand of Mercy in their first appearance were as interesting as the Gorn were in Arena.
It has to, yeah, but it could be just as simple as whoever was writing Friday's Child did not like alligators and, you know, was told, all right, use an alien species from earlier in this episode, you know, because we want to reuse for, you know, mythologizing purposes, and he just happened to really like one of the Klingon episodes. It could just be as simple as that.
Well, there was only one Klingon episode at that point. But yeah, I think it just has to do with the fact that there weren't that many options. And
yeah.
I think the Gorn are just a non-starter because, you know, the suit doesn't look that great. And I think they know that. And the Gorn worked as it did in Arena because it was just a nameless, faceless enemy that was sort of like, you know, in the Predator vein, I guess.
Yeah.
And... not Predator like the Predator like the movie, I'm saying.
That's what
And just to make that clear. And I think, you know, you can't really have a Gorn character just because the suit doesn't lend itself to that and they can't talk in the suit. So those are two strikes against it, I think.
That then, yeah, it could be as simple as that. They just couldn't figure out a way to make it feasible at that time.
Yeah. All right, do you have anything else to say about the Deadly Years?
Just that, what kind of colony was this? Because at one point they say, you know, on the experimental colony, and there is that pause in the line, and that made me very nervous about what the point of this thing was.
I think it was a sex colony.
I didn't want to say it, but I picture old people boning.
Yeah, I think that, well, they weren't old, but...
Well, they're old-looking people. Aged people.
Well, they weren't old when they were supposed to be there, though.
They were wizened.
True.
Age is just a number, my friend. Also, I miss Yeoman Rand.
Yeah.
I really miss Yeoman Rand. Every time there's a Yeoman, I'm like, why aren't you Rand?
One other thing I want to mention, then we'll wrap this up, is I just like the concept of stargrams. Did you catch that reference?
No, I didn't.
There, when Kirk and in the very early part of the episode, when Kirk and the endocrinologist are talking about their history, she says, well, you sent me a stargram once. I don't know. I just thought that was funny. I just like that concept. I don't even know if that ever comes up again. But,
oh, that's cute.
You know, it's just like, it's so weird to get little things like that, which place the original series in a particular moment in time.
Yeah.
Like the whole idea of playing back tapes and, you know, record tapes, which happened, I think, in the last episode with the Klingons.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Scotty asked Sulu to play back the record tape. And then with the order that turned out to be false. And then in this episode with Stargram, of course, being a telegram.
Yeah, it's the far in the future version of some and what we now know is an outdated form.
Yeah, so it just makes you think about, like, you know, what is going to be viewed as outdated from our science fiction, you know, in 50 years, like, you know, and then like Fringe or something, or Battlestar Galactica or any number of shows. I mean, cell phones
will look ridiculous one day.
Yeah, like, I mean, think about it in terms of, like, okay, well, the communicators on Star Trek are small, and that, you know, definitely. The flip phones that we have were inspired by that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the little earpieces that people are wearing in Battlestar Galactica are going to look at as odd in the future.
Well, I mean,
you know,
I see the way the earpieces in Star Trek look. They look very silly because, you know, nowadays, like, what Uhura is wearing would be closer to a Bluetooth, which is very tiny, you know? It would be a very small thing that she
Bluetooth was inspired by her earpiece.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
A lot of stuff.
I figured that would make sense that it is.
Yeah.
Science fiction in general is in a dialogue with technology, in that, you know, the fiction comes from the existing technology and then that will inspire other things. So,
I mean, I think the whole, you know, desire among people to have, you know, tablet computers comes from, you know, that's not something that is, you know, weird. I mean, we see that in Star Trek all the time.
Oh, we see it in sci-fi in general. Yeah. I mean, how much does, when you're at the Apple store and you see the people with their carrying their iPads, how future does that look?
Yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, when I was in grad school and I walked into the library one day and they had overnight had suddenly replaced all of the huge CRT monitors with flat panels.
Yeah.
And it was just like, whoa, like, looks like the future in here now.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I don't know. It's fun.
Yeah, I worked at my library in college when they did that. And, you know, I leaned against the microfiche machine and I said, we are living in the future.
And then you pointed at the sky. All right. So how many tribbles would you give this episode?
I would give this 9 tribbles.
Really? You liked it that much?
Yes, because of it would have been a lower tribble score, but the reference to Corbomite and the torture of Chekhov has given it a full tribble.
All right. I'll give it 8.
Okay.
So actually, I think your average is higher than mine this week, which I don't know has ever happened before.
Well, good for me.
All right. Well, next week we will discuss Obsession and Wolf in the Fold.
A musician, a musician.
We'll talk to you then.